Hello there, and welcome to episode 2020 of our podcast. Though we are no longer called Laser Guided Melodies, we're in that weird stage of limbo between changing our identity. We're now called The Student Playlist, if you haven't already twigged from our Facebook and Twitter change. But, you know, we haven't renamed the podcast yet. These things take time, people.
No, but it's new year and time for a new start, I think. So we're going to be doing these podcast once a month now, not kind of every 2/3/4 weeks or however, whenever we manage to get it together, basically. So hopefully that's bring more sense of order to proceedings.
So today we'll be reviewing our highlights of all the albums released in January 2015. And if you're not familiar with the show's format, I introduce things and sit back and read my book as Ed rants at length about whatever we're talking about.
Yeah, well, that's what we have done in the past. That basically was it, boiled down. But, I don't know, that's a bit more sense of equality about proceedings.
New year, new energy.
Yeah, indeed.
Let's give it a go. So the albums we'll be reviewing today on the show, with clips, underlined, are Bjork's Vulnicura, Mark Ronson's Uptown Special, Belle and Sebastian's Girls in Peacetime Want to Dance, and Enter Shikari's The Mind Sweep. And after that, we'll be talking about some classic albums that have enjoyed birthdays recently. Bob Dylan's Blood on the Tracks, LCD's Sound System's self-titled...
Debut.
So as usual, to start with, we'll be talking about some exciting music news that has recently occurred.
I know. what? Some things that have happened.
They've taken place.
First of all, some things what happened in January.
Firstly, New Order have announced their first album in 10 years, and this has made Ed tingle with excitement.
Oh, not half. Yeah, the first album in a decade from New Order, a new lineup for the band. Peter Hook, the band's legendary bassist, who always used to stand on the right-hand side of stage, he's gone. He's gone and formed his own sort of Joy Division splinter band and covers Joy Division songs for a living. But New Order's original keyboardist Gillian Gilbert is back in the lineup, so this is kind of back where we were 10 years ago, was just with three of the New Order members. They've got a new album coming out probably in autumn this year. They reformed in 2013. They toured extensively last year. They debuted two new songs, one of which was called Plastic, and the other of which escapes my mind. But these two will be on the new record. They signed with the staunchly independent Mute Records. It's been going for a long time. I'm really excited because it's going to be new tours and get to dance to the old classics all over again. Oh, how exciting.
Secondly, a lesser known and underground artist called Bjork, I believe, has released a new album that got leaked. And wait, what's that? What's that, Ed? Bjork?
Yes.
Bjork.
Yes, Bjork.
Weird.
Yes.
So yeah, Bjork has released her new album, Vulnicura. Vulnicura?
We don't know how it's supposed to be pronounced. Go for whatever you want.
She released it in response to a leak. It's unclear when she was originally planning on dropping the work, but...
Oh, I know that.
She pretty much had to...
Yeah. It was supposed to be March 23rd. The physical releases on CD and vinyl are still going to be on that date, but on January the 20th she dropped the new record on iTunes, so it's there for you to listen to right now. I don't think it's on Spotify
yet. Companies very annoyed apparently, because basically she gave exclusivity to iTunes on that day, and so
yeah, well, she could do what she wants with it. It's the hacker's fault, don't blame her.
I think they've had to rearrange a few of the contracts with the rough trade and things because the physical sales will have been impacted by iTunes dominance. What did you think? What did you think, Ed?
Well, yeah, I reviewed this for the site. I'm a huge Bjork fan, so I've been looking forward to this, and to have it delivered 2 months early was, you know, really good thing to happen. I wish this kind of thing would happen more often, artists taking more responsibility for this kind of thing. Anyway, Bjork has been something of an auteur, by which I mean somebody who infused every single element of their music with their own vision. And you can tell from pretty much any kind of 4 or 5 second clip of any Bjork song that it is her. It's just, her sound is unmistakable, even though it's quite sort of vague and ethereal, isn't it?
Yeah, on the first listen, the album is just a wash of pleasantness. It's really hard to tell the difference between each individual song. But then it's on the second and third and fourth, etc., listens, the highlights begin to pull through when you realise that there's some clever things going on with different beats and melodies.
Yeah.
You know, apparently she has said that it took her so long because she's basically micromanaged all the rhythms to the, you know, tenths of seconds.
Yeah.
To give it that skittery sound and structure that yeah. has become her trademark.
Although she said in the run-up to the release of this that it would have taken her even longer if she hadn't have hooked up with Arca, who is the producer of this album. He was also responsible for Kanye West's Yeezus back in 2013 and for FKA Twigs LP1, and both of those records featured, I think, in the top five of our albums of the year for their respective years, so we can rightly expect very, very good things indeed. And so it has come to pass. He's an absolutely perfect fit for Bjork's vision, as far as I'm concerned. I mean, if you listen to kind of these chains of beats, they'll sound like stuff that Bjork has done before, because it's most similar to Vespertine, which was released in 2001. I think it shares kind of a musical similarity with it. Although it's made clearly by machines, they sound kind of human in their own way. It's just that very special blend that Arca and Bjork have both achieved in the past, and they're just perfect for each other on this. And we're going to play a clip for you now. It's called Mouth Mantra, and see what you think.
So that was Mouth Mantra from Bjork's latest album, Vulnicura, that we're talking about. And it's very much a breakup album.
Yeah. She broke up with her partner, I think, of about 10 years, called Matthew Barney, who is also the father of her children. So it is a heartbreak album. It's difficult to see it in any other kind of context.
It's a story.
Yeah.
Different levels. Yeah, there's a protagonist, there's an outcome.
Yeah. I mean, and the tracks they're not kind of verse, chorus, verse, normal pop structures here. They're very kind of non-linear. They're based around sort of Bjork's introspective musings, and there's kind of a strange sort of mutual relationship between the singer and the music, because Arca's soundscapes sort of expand and contract to kind of match and reflect her mood at any given time, coupled with the way that what she's done before, which is to try and remove herself from her own situation. So she paradoxically sounds quite detached from the whole situation, like she's like looking from far away at her own situation, but and describing what she's going through in outside of a first person narrative. It's odd, because she's singing about heartbreak and it's painful to listen to, but she uses weird phrases like lyrics like, "These abstract complex feelings, I do not know how to handle them." So she sounds quite sort of robotic, but you know, it's very sort of on the nose at the same time. And there's lots of key words being bandied around, particularly in like the opener, Stone Milker. There's lots of words like emotions, respect, mutual, feelings. These are like all like the key words that let you know what kind of emotional territory we're in. I guess the highlight is the 10-minute centrepiece. It's called Black Lake, and it's got these twisted alien kind of soundscapes that like shift and contort and mutate themselves through their like kind of different subparts over the running time. It's the most intricate moment on here, but every track is really great. Because the thematic building blocks, like Lauren said, they're the same, so all the tracks share kind of a musical similarity, but what Arca and Bjork do with them on each track, when you listen to them more, the differences come out, meaning that it's consistent, but each moment is unique.
The album is defined by these big, big symphonic swells that gives it this cinematic feeling. But as a side note on Bjork, I heard her interviewed on the radio the other day, and for someone with such a diverse musical vocabulary, she doesn't half say like and kind of a lot.
Yeah, I mean, because she's Icelandic, she's obviously, but her English is really good, but it's not absolutely perfect. Mm. So she does use quite a lot of English colloquialism pretty well. She's quite strong.
So it's funny.
She's not a person to listen to, I guess. But it's not quite as good as Homogenic, which in my opinion is one of the best albums of the 90s. It invented Kid A before Kid A was a thing. It's definitely her best album in a decade, though. It's better than Biophilia, and I don't say that lightly. 9 out of 10.
So we've started on a high. Now what about Mark Ronson's Uptown Special? Right. Okay. That doesn't sound good. In the meantime, listen to this clip, Daffodils feat. Kevin Parker. Was the Kevin Parker featuring track Daffodils from Mark Ronson's new album Uptown Special. It's been everywhere. What more can we say? Talk, monkey.
Talk reviews, monkey. Right, yeah. So basically, you'd have to be living under a rock, in a cave, on the moon, not to have heard Uptown Funk by now. It's just a song that's been absolutely everywhere for at least 2 months.
How does it go?
Go on, you do it.
Uptown Funky Walk. Uptown Funky Walk.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Right, so, but it's been very divisive, right? For every person who loves it, at least one person hates it, including me. But he must be quite used to this by now, because if you remember Version back in 2007, the album that really made his name, that was like the coffee table album of the year. Like, everybody had it. It was the second biggest selling album of the year. But for every person who loved it, there were people like me who just hated all the really cheesy brass interpretations of stuff like Radiohead and The Smiths and The Charlatans.
I wouldn't say hated. Terrible. I think people were sceptical of Mark Ronson and the way he seems to shoot straight for the charts rather than, you know, he's undoubtedly talented, but sometimes it feels like that money is his number one game.
It wasn't that at all. I just think it was cynical and needless in quite a lot of occasions. Anyway, that was my personal feeling. So, after that experience, I really, really wanted to hate Uptown Special, which is the album that Uptown Funk comes from, but I don't. You can read Uptown Special as kind of Ronson's reaction to the current state of music, because he's frequently bemoaned the state of the charts in the recent past. And so what he's done on Uptown Special is to kind of revisit the 70s funk and soul that he grew up with when he was a kid. He takes care of the music, but on 9 out of the 11 tracks on the album, he's brought in an author called Michael Chabon to write the lyrics. You've still got the kind of old Ronson formula of guest stars everywhere.
You know, horns. There's always so many horns.
Yeah, there's
and
horns
trumpets.
Everywhere. But you know, Bruno Mars obviously is on it. But elsewhere, you've got Kevin Parker from Tame Impala, who brings a great shot of indie credibility to the project. He's on 3 songs, including the one you just heard. Mystical, if you remember him, the rapper, you know, sort of that gravelly voice, sort of shouty rapper from 2000, he's on it. Jeff Basker,
like
Andrew Wyatt, and even Stevie Flippin' Wonder is on it. But I think the one thing you'll notice when you listen to it is that other than Uptown Funk and a couple of other songs called Feel Right and Can't Lose, which arrive consecutively near each other, near the start, it's a very chilled out affair. It's suitable for dinner parties and drinks gatherings, not dance floors. And it's probably something that most fans of Uptown Funk wouldn't have expected Ronson to do here. And by and large, it holds together. It's by no means a perfect album, because the second half does kind of drop off quite a bit, and you really need to concentrate to listen to it. But musically, it's very consistent. Yeah, it's probably the best album he's ever done, in my opinion. But that depends on whether you loved or hated Version. And I awarded it 6. What did you make of it, Lauren?
Well, if you're a Radio 1 listener, you'd have thought that that was the only song that's been released this month, because they just constantly play it. And it's had the same exposure as Daft Punk's Lucky. you know,
Get Lucky.
Yeah, Daft Punk's Get Lucky. And unlike Random Access Memories, which served up more of that nostalgic retro...
I thought that was a fantastic album.
Served up more of the retro genre. Mark Ronson leads with Uptown Funk, which is tremendously retro. You know, it taps into everyone's love of disco music, soul.
Soul, yeah.
You know, Bruno Mars, his voice is transformed. And it's, you know, made me see him in a different light, certainly. But then the rest of the album doesn't necessarily follow in the same vein. It doesn't really deliver. So if you liked Uptown Funk for its genre alone, you might be disappointed with the rest.
Yeah. Yeah, I think you'd probably have to have a deeper knowledge of soul and funk in general to enjoy this album. It's not like not every moment is as accessible as Uptown Funk. Yeah, decent, not great, but decent. What we got next?
Belle and Sebastian's "Girls in Peacetime Want to Dance."
Yeah,
we'll start with this clip, "The Party Line."
You knew me, and you end up dancing closer to me. I know that I broke the rule already.
The Party Line by Belle and Sebastian there, from their new album Girls in Peacetime Want to Dance.
So
I did want to dance to that song.
Yeah,
whether we're in peacetime or not is debatable.
It's very surprising. I mean, cowbells on a Belle and Sebastian track? What's happening?
Everyone's been bemused by this latest release because it's so danceable.
Yeah, basically, it's their third in nearly a decade. It's their longest gap between records so far. Their last album was 2010, and that was called Belle and Sebastian Write About Love. And that wasn't... It wasn't very good. It was a bit of a fiasco, that record. It was inconsistent and it felt very predictable. But, so what they've done is they've got rid of Tony Hoffer, who produced that album. They brought in Ben Allen III, who... I know, great name, right? But he produced the last Kaiser Chiefs record and several records by Bombay Bicycle Club. So, and that seems to have inspired them to rediscover their kind of energy, their joie de vivre a bit, to use a bit Ponty French.
That translates as disco rhythms.
Yeah, but it's still got that kind of shy, whimsical perkiness that used to make their kind of first records in the 90s so compelling. There's kind of like string sweat moments, like folk as well, and the kind of sprightly hits of chamber pop that we're all used to. So they tick a lot of the old boxes, wistful lyrics set to pop tunes and vice versa. And like you just heard on The Party Line, they chuck in a few new ingredients like cowbells. There's a song called Enter Sylvia Plath, which is like quite a campy disco number, isn't it? It's just something you never thought they'd be capable of.
Indie eats itself.
Yeah, and like, you know, and Twee House as well on Play for Today. I mean, yeah, that song's slightly too long, but it was pretty enjoyable on the whole, I thought.
It's a good, uplifting album, but the lyrics... You know, the delivery is still classic Belle and Sebastian.
Yeah, Stuart Murdoch's... Yeah, he's still got the touch.
Still mournful, still introspective.
Yeah, but also kind of quite sort of funny in the same way that Morrissey used to be able to sort of make tragedy funny. Yeah. It's got some faults, though. It's slightly too long at 13 tracks and nearly 55 minutes. They could easily have lopped off two of the tracks and not had any sort of impact whatsoever. The dance-orientated ones in particular tend to outstay their welcome. Play for Today lasts for nearly 8 minutes, but doesn't really need to. But they are comparatively minor plaints, and it's just really, really good to see Belle and Sebastian back again, I think. And considering Belle and Sebastian were formed as like a school music project to pass their A-levels in 1995, and they never intended it to last for more than 2 years, and here they are, they're, you know, nearly approaching their third decade now.
And the music scene is all the richer for it. Indeed. Surely.
7 out of 10.
Finally. He knows what's coming.
Oh.
Enter Shikari's The Minesweep has recently been released. Ed's gearing up for a rant, I'm not so sure. Yeah. Just listen to this, The Last Garrison, and make your mind up. Can you hear the war cry? The adrenaline burst through the ripple banks. Welcome to the skirmish.
Okay, so you can turn your generic music devices back up again. Enter Shikari is over.
Recover your eardrums.
That was The Last Garrison from their fourth album, The Minesweep, which currently sits at number 6 in the album's chart. Lauren really loves this.
I wouldn't say love.
You like it.
Yeah. I would give it a solid 7, and here's why. I think it's a good album. Their first album was, in my opinion, a work of art. Second and third, not so much. And The Minesweep is their return to form, I believe. It's loud, it's shout, it's definitely not perfect. And some of the lyrics, some of the political themes are quite ham-fisted. You know, there's no ambiguity to what they're saying.
It's terrible. It's like listening to a really eager sixth form student saying, oh, look how many books I've read, or how many books I've read the back of.
Yeah.
Okay, just take this. Take this, right? I think it's called Never Let Go of the Microscope. I think that's one of the tracks.
Yeah.
The lyric goes, like Socrates, I graze on the slopes of the summit of my own ignorance. Honestly, mate, go back to school. Learn how to write.
The first thing I thought when I got given this to review was, wow, aren't video game soundtracks getting more sophisticated these days? And it's true, you know, it's a genre of its own. You know, video game soundtracks can climb the charts, and this sounds like one. It sounds like, you know, you're controlling a character on the screen and they should be like kicking things and driving things and blasting things, because that's always been Enshikari's sound. It's electro dubstep mixed with metal mashup. And it doesn't really sound like anything else. There's Skrillex, there's Linkin Park, there's Pendulum, if you can even remember them.
None of these examples are ones to support any kind of argument.
Exactly.
They're all terrible.
Exactly. Which, it should be a bad thing, but it's not, because they've injected enough of their own sound to it and their own direction into it to make it not feel derivative. So you don't listen to it, and even though some of the lyrics are a bit cliched, the album as a whole doesn't feel like a pastiche.
Well, okay, here's another lyrical gem here from the opener, The Appeal and the Minesweep One. It's a spoken word kind of rap thing, the introduction, isn't it? This is an appeal to the struggling and striving on this floating rock we call Earth.
Oh, yeah, well, the album is sort of bookended by these two
incredibly overbearing
call to arms, where Roe Reynolds is basically shouting at the listener. And that's annoying, yes, I know. But the rest of the album, the clip you heard, The Last Garrison, that's good. The Anaesthetist. Yeah, if you can pronounce it, yeah. Which has been played quite a lot on Radio 1, is also good. And there are...
But anyway, if I might jump in here, I can see the appeal of Enter Shikari as kind of a gateway band to other bands like Black Flag and The Clash and other bands who use this kind of lyrical agitprop style that Roe Reynolds, that's his name.
Yeah.
That's what he uses, right? Now, fair enough. But all I can say is, if you're listening to this and you're over the age of 17, grow up. There are so many elements just all packed together trying to vie for attention that they may as well just be spot welded together clumsily in the middle. It's really arbitrary. And paradoxically, though, in the rush to experiment, everything sounds very unoriginal and predictable and formulaic. It's just there's no nous involved. That the intention is admirable. They're trying to engage their listeners. Fair enough. There needs to be more bands like that, but Enter Shikari are just really clumsy.
You're trying to critically analyse something that doesn't really need to be. Yeah, they're childish, but what is their music for? Enter Shikari's music, even though they're trying to make it sound like it should be the audio, you know, the music equivalent of Russell Brand, you know, calling people to arms, trying to get
people
politically motivated.
Well, that's the
problem.
I think Russell Brand's a clumsy, ham-fisted...
Yeah, exactly.
Agitprop.
Ultimately, Enter Shikari are a rock dance floor, dance hall band. They're for, you know, pumping out, not easily listening, certainly not. And there's a certain... I don't know where I'm going with this.
I think it also depends on whether you actually like their kind of mixture of post-hardcore and happy hardcore in the first place. And I didn't. The reason they got that John Peel Award for Innovation is because because New Rave was a thing at the time and people didn't know it wasn't going to last. And so Enter Shikari still have this kind of stamp of artistic credibility upon them when they really don't deserve it at all.
But in the same year, they were also awarded, I think it was Kerrang's Best Live Band, which was big at the time because it definitely, that's what brought them to my attention and plenty of other people, because they were very much unknown and it got more people to the live shows, which is where the whole Enter Shikari machine works. You know, whether it's under the moniker Enter Shikari or whether it's, I think they also perform under Shikari Sound System, or I think it's like Rutron 5000 or something. They're a dance metal band. I don't know what metal. Yeah, it doesn't sound good on paper, but this album is not awful. It's not like Skrillex's latest album or anything.
Oh, well, very few things are as bad as that. I mean, for God's sake, I mean, there's no need to be that comparison. That's overly cruel, but it's just very loud.
Mm.
Please, you know, and also lighten up. You can be like Pulled Apart by Horses or Future of the Left, and you can achieve the same kind of sort of, you can incite people to action and still be funny. There's just no sense of humour in it at all. That's another big problem.
Pitchforks out, Ed.
Yeah, I know. 3 out of 10, and that's being kind. Anyway, other opinions are available, but I thought it was awful on that down note. Let's move on.
Let's just briefly skim over some of the other records that we've been reviewing on the site, starting with Ponds, Man, It Feels Like Space Again. I had the pleasure of reviewing this one, and it was a complete pleasure. Everything about the album is wondrous. It's a joy to behold from
Start to finish. It's just really good. Yeah. There's loads of experimentation going on, but they neatly pack it into kind of a 45 minute.
Yeah, 9 tracks. It's not long, and but at the same time it feels wholesome, because there's lots of things going on, lots of happy pop melodies.
So I guess this is for fans of Tame Impala. They'd like this sort of thing.
Yeah, so you'd think that Nick Albrook, who was formerly the Tame Impala bassist, you'd think he'd be mental to leave Tame Impala when they'd just basically just broken into the mainstream. Then you listen to his work with Pond and you realise that he probably made a good decision.
Yeah, I mean, they're a very prolific 6 albums in 6 years. But what did you give it out of 10?
9.
High praise indeed. Other albums that are out, Sleater Kinney are back. If you're fans of kind of your feminist punk music from the 90s, you'll be glad. That was a really good record.
Why did that sound disdainful? Feminist punk?
Feminist punk. I love Sleater Kinney. I don't mean to sound dismissive at all. Panda Bear from Animal Collective, he's back. He's got a new album called Panda Bear Meets the Grim Reaper, which is also very good. There's a debut album by a Canadian group called Viet Cong, who used to be a band called Women, who retitled themselves after their guitarist died a few years ago. That's their debut. It's for fans of Joy Division, really like that. The Decemberists are back. They had a US number one album last time out. They're back. That's also pretty good. The Charlatans are back, which we're really pleased to see after the amount of tragedy they've suffered. Fall Out Boy, who are currently number one in America. You've listened to this, Laura, and I haven't, so give us a little bit of a roundup.
It's a snatch at the mainstream, and it sounds like they've done quite well with it. It's not an album I particularly enjoyed, but it's probably going to gain them more fans in areas other than rock.
What would you get out of 10?
4 or 5. I didn't care. I couldn't care for it.
I did not care for it. And also, Gaz Coombs, formerly of Supergrass, is back with his second solo album called Matador. Matthew Langham is reviewing that. It's not on the site yet, but it will be in the next couple
of
days.
Look out for that one. And it's that time in the show again where we say happy birthday to a series of very special classic albums that are celebrating a significant milestone or have significated.
Significance.
We'll start with Bob Dylan's Blood on the Tracks, which was 40 years old on the 20th of January. While you reminisce, let's listen to 3 clips, Tangled Up in Blue, Shelter from the Storm, and Lily, Rosemary and the Jack of Hearts. Still red. Her folks, they said our lives together sure was gonna be rough. They never did like Mama's homemade dress. Papa's bank book wasn't big enough. And I was standing on the side of the road, rain falling on my shoes, heading out for the East Coast. Lord knows I paid some dues getting through, tangled up in blue.
And if I pass this way again, you can rest assured I'll always do my best for her, on that I give my word. In a world of steel at death and men who are fighting to be warm, come in, she said, I'll give ya shelter from the storm. Not a word was spoke between us, there was a little risk involved. Everything up to... I know I've seen that face somewhere, Big Jim was thinking to himself. Maybe down in Mexico, or a picture upon somebody's shelf. But then the crowd began to stamp the feet, and the house lights did dim. There was only Jim and him, staring at the butterfly who just drew the jack of hearts.
You just heard some clips from Bob Dylan's Blood on the Tracks, and if you've been looking at the blog recently, you'll have noticed that Ed wrote 2,000 words on the subject. So I'm sure that his vocal appraisal of this album is going to be no less lengthy.
Yeah.
We might as well start now. Go, talk.
Try and keep it short. Right, so Dylan, he's about to release his 35th studio album in a couple of weeks' time. If you've got a best of album and think that's all there is to Dylan, you think again. If you're looking for an entry point into his huge back catalogue, Blood on the Tracks has an awful lot going for it. It's his best-selling album by quite a distance. But in some ways, it's something of an anomaly, because Dylan is basically famous for his, you know, imperial phase from 1964 to 1966, when he did six brilliant albums in a row that influenced pretty much every artist in the 60s. But Blood on the Tracks is from 1975, so that's nearly a decade afterwards, and it was after his motorcycle accident in 67, and after he'd made a string of consciously quite simplistic records that made everybody wonder by 1975 whether Dylan had lost his touch, whether his, you know, whether outside of the 60s Dylan actually meant anything anymore. But three things provided the impetus for Blood on the Tracks. He spent most of 1974 on the road with the band, and he got the rockish tendency out of him, and he wanted to return back to his acoustic roots. He also took up painting, and he learned sort of about through the construction of art about how to make music in a different way. He said at the time, when you look at a painting, you can see any part of it or see all of it all together at once. At the same time, he was also splitting up with his wife Sarah, who was mother of four of his children. And so what you get with Blood on the Tracks is kind of a deeply confessional subtext to everything. It makes the songs difficult to see in any other light. So it's a stripped down Dylan, something we're not really used to. And it's the poise with which he tackles the subject matter that would go on to influence pretty much every other singer-songwriter all over again for a second time. You take Tangled Up in Blue, that first clip. Yeah, it lets you see that new side of him, despite his use of, sort of shifting tenses and metaphors and setting, because it takes place in this mythical American landscape. If you try and imagine it in your head, it doesn't really make sense, but it's kind of moving at the same time. He said himself it took 10 years to live and 2 years to write that song. You've also... there's kind of like the mysterious centrepiece of this entire album called... Lily Rosemary and the Jack of Hearts, which is the last clip that you heard. It sticks out like a sore thumb amongst all these kind of gentle acoustic moments, because its rhythm is kind of, you know, hillbilly, like dum 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 dum. But in many ways, it is the thematic core of the album, despite being on the surface completely different. To me, it's more than any other song in his entire history, illustrates why Dylan is such a songwriting genius, or why he's considered to be such a songwriting genius. This song is 9 minutes long, 15 verses long. It's all about a murder and a robbery executed by this fellow called the Jack of Hearts, who's this sort of mysterious, elusive character at the centre of the song. All three of the characters in the song, they kind of disguise criminal motives with romantic facades, or vice versa, depending on your reading of the song. As it relates to the album, which is a heartbreak album, you could see the criminal double dealings of the characters as a reflection of the recriminations and the accusations you get when a relationship is falling apart. I can't think of any other song in pop history that's been made into two screenplays. although they eventually got, they didn't get made. Anyway, back to Blood on the Tracks as a whole. 6 out of 10 of the songs are masterpieces, and they could have been the highlight of any other Dylan album. And even the weaker moments are only weaker just by comparison to such strong songs. And the kind of outlet you get is, it's exactly the kind of thing that Bon Iver kind of channeled with Forever, Forever Ago. Do you remember that? That was 2008. That kind of haunted loneliness, the isolation you get with the songs, that poise. And most importantly, it proved to everybody all over again that Dylan's power was not bound up with the 60s. He made sense outside of that decade. And he followed up with another great album called Desire, then a kind of dodgy album called Street Legal. Then he became a Christian and made 3 kind of quite preachy and very poor albums in a row. And then the 80s happened, which was his kind of fallow period creatively. Mm. So this would be like the best Dylan got for quite a while, until the mid-90s when suddenly people rediscovered him again.
He's had his ups and downs, but this was definitely his golden era.
It was his brief second golden age after the 60s, certainly. Any thoughts? Sorry, I tried to keep that as short as possible, but what next?
LCD Sound System's self-titled debut was 10 years old on the 24th of January. Listen to this now. Daft Punk is playing at my house and Tribulations. Well, Daft Punk is playing at my house. Said a few clips from LCD Sound System's self-titled debut, which is now 10 years old. LCD is a particular love of Ed's.
Yeah. So LCD Sound System and The Cribs soundtracked university for me. So I have a great deal of, sort of personal affection for them. They both kind of personify the spirit of invention that's like an inherent part of all truly great indie music. Though this album was 2005, the LCD Sound System story started in 2002 with a series of double-A-sided singles. Called Losing My Edge was the first one. And actually, Lauren's boyfriend's band used the same sample thing, that dum-dum-dum-dum-dum, ch-ch.
Boom-boom-boom-boom-boom-boom.
That's called Losing My Edge. That was kind of a tragic tale of this hipster who was aging and losing, you know, losing touch, losing his edge. There's a song called Yeah, which there were 2 versions of, Beat Connection, Your City's a Sucker. They were all double A-sided singles that were released between 02 and 05. But his first, James Murphy, the genius behind LCD Sound System and the owner of DFA Records, his first masterstroke was to put all of those songs on a second disc on LCD Sound System, which immediately added value to everybody who was curious about LCD Sound System but wasn't yet converted. It made it a better deal to buy. So it was a masterstroke. It made, even though that they were kind of a hipster's band, they were saying, okay, you weren't around for the first 3 years, that's no problem, you can catch up. But the other great triumph of this album is that it made dance music sound human. Just like Bjork and Volnicura, which we were talking about earlier, it's difficult to distinguish which parts are human and which parts are machine. Because of the dual approach that James Murphy uses of drums and drum machines, combined with cowbells, which are everywhere on this album, and pretty crisply recorded hi-hats, which are very prominent in the mix. So it basically meant that although there were loads of really established influences, like Can, Brian Eno, Suicide, Talking Heads, The Fall, but Murphy was able to blend them into something very contemporary at the time. the ratio of dance music to indie music could like vary from time to time. Daft Punk is playing at my house. That was the opening track of the album. You just heard a clip of that. That's quite an angular kind of punky kind of assault. It sounds more like guitar music. But Tribulations is a very sort of bassline heavy and more of a dance kind of thing. But it's still got the kind of post-punk guitar scratches all over it. So, yeah, they were like they kind of rearranged the formula each time, and it came out with just something totally unique. And so basically the entire album plays like a greatest hit for an hour and 40 minutes. It's a very long album, but it was the sense of abandon and the eagerness of the whole thing was what carried the day. It's not their best album. They went on to make their masterpiece a couple of years later. It was called Sound of Silver. But for me, LCD Sound System is one of like the essential debut albums of the noughties.
Don't you have a really interesting anecdote about LCD Sound System? Did you meet them in a bar or something?
I actually met them at an LCD Sound System gig. I met James Murphy.
Figures.
Yeah. Hot Chip were supporting. Just name drop there. This was before Hot Chip were big. I think it may have well been that song. And my friend John and I were standing at the back near the bar, and there was kind of a fat guy in a beard and a hoodie who was propping up the bar next to us. I said to John, "That's James Murphy." You know, he's like, "No way! Don't be ridiculous. That's just a fat guy in a hoodie." So I bet him next round of drinks. I said to him, "You James Murphy?" And I went, "Yeah, well, oh, I fucking told you."
Bet you did.
Yeah. So I have met the great man once, and I called him a genius, and he went, "Thanks." And he really did sound very pleased to hear that.
Then we should have a segment in one of these podcasts about our best gig anecdotes. Because we must have a good collection between us.
Well, how many famous people have we met?
Yeah, or just funny things that have happened at gigs. Maybe that's one to think about for next time.
Yeah, Black Rebel Motorcycle Club once told me to piss off.
Whoa.
But yeah, that's for another time. But anyway, they turned out to be jerks, and they're not famous anymore, so ha ha ha.
But why did they tell you to piss off?
Because basically we asked for autographs.
Did you go up and badger them?
We went and asked them for autographs.
What's wrong with that?
Exactly. And they told me and my friends to piss off.
Really?
Yeah, bunch of bastards.
Rude.
Yeah. Sorry, got a bit sweary there. So.
That's all for this week. The February edition in a month's time. It's not as exciting as Vogue's.
No.
But.
No, it's more exciting than Vogue. What are we talking about? We're all about promotion and not self-deprecation here. Come on.
But we'll be reviewing in depth Peace, Idlewild and Imagine Dragons. Meanwhile, under the site, you can look out for Bob Dylan, Black Rivers, Carl Barat and the Jackals, Gang of Four, The Pop Group.
Yeah, two big 70s post-punk bands making new
Father
records.
Father John Misty, Public Service Broadcasting, and, if it's out, Frank Turner.
Yeah.
Other album anniversaries that are coming up soon and you may want to keep an eye out for, The Smiths' Meet His Murder, which will be 30 years old on the 11th of February, and Block Party's Silent Alarm, which will be 10 years old a few days later on the 14th. In the meantime, as always, keep interacting with us however you want to. Whether it's, you know, you give one of us a slap when you see us, or more preferably, you can tweet us.
They don't know what we look like. We're unslappable.
I think it wouldn't be that hard to find out.
Though I do have a slappable face.
It's true.
Yeah.
Anyway, our Twitter is at Student Playlist. That is our new Twitter.
New Twitter handle,
not Laser Guided Melodies anymore. So make sure you're updated on that. And
If you were a follower of us before, you will automatically still follow us again. I've only just changed the handle. So.
Yeah. Very smart of you.
Yeah. So yeah, and our website is thestudentplaylist.com, all one word.
Yeah.
Oh, so did you want to do that?
No. Right. Without further ado, what would you say your album of the month is?
Albums of the month.
Didn't hesitate. Mine's Pond. Let's just get that out there.
I'd say third Viet Cong, the debut. Again, for fans of Joy Division and all post-punk, like Public Image Limited, you really love this. Pond, I'd say very close second behind Bjork, Volnicura, I think, is album of the month. We'll see you at the end of February.
Have a good month. Stay safe. Goodbye. Bye.